You know, in the last couple of decades, this planet of ours has seen a couple of billion babies born. And yet, I have to tell you that despite the frequency of their appearances, I find them very, very, very mysterious little creatures. I've got a bad habit of wandering up to total strangers and staring at their babies because I really don't get babies. I've had a few of my own, but you know, where did they come from? No, okay, I know about storks and under cabbages, but look at a baby. Who are they? Now, we expect our kids to be pretty much like us, and we're constantly surprised when they arrive in the world with their own identity. But what if your child is really different, profoundly different to you? What if, for example, you're straight, the child's gay, if you can hear, they're deaf, if they're autistic? And what if much darker differences, if our children become troubled, mentally ill, or succumb to crime? As promised, Andrew Solomon has investigated these dilemmas in a book, Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. It's a book he spent over a decade researching and writing. He's interviewed hundreds of parents, kids, experts, unearthing some fascinating stories, which he tells through a very humane perspective. And he joins us now from New York. Andrew, welcome to our little wireless program.
What a pleasure to be here.
Andrew, you and I had a very interesting and similar trauma. About 20 years ago, we did a program on technologies that were being employed to give deaf children, profoundly deaf children, hearing. It was a well-intended little program. Little did I realise all hell would break loose because we became targeted by the Deaf Pride community, who accused the program, and indeed my good self, of advocating a form of cultural genocide. Now, you discovered this phenomenon, didn't you, when you were writing a story about deaf culture for the New York Times?
I did, and I was very taken aback by it at the time. My assignment was to write about the emergence of deaf culture, and I had thought of deafness as entirely a disability and a grave misfortune. Those poor people, they couldn't hear. It would be great if we could do something for them. And then I went out into the deaf world, and I went to deaf clubs, and I went to performances of deaf theater, and I went to all kinds of things. I even went to the Miss Deaf America contest. And what I came away with is the understanding that there really is a culture in deafness, and it's a culture organized around the use of sign language. And while it wasn't my culture and I didn't want to join it, I thought it was quite a beautiful culture and quite a compelling one.
And indeed, members of that culture quite defiantly suggest that it can be superior to ours, superior in the subtlety of expression, for example.
I think what they mostly suggested was that it could be a subtle and compelling and engaging and thrilling culture. I don't know that they were disparaging our culture particularly and throwing in that contrast, but they had a real sense that it was their culture and they were very proud of it and they found a lot of joy in it, and that the idea of eliminating deafness was the idea of eliminating a whole way of being. And they compared it a lot to saying, you know, would you eliminate an ethnic minority? Would you eliminate gay people? Would you eliminate people who are different in any other way?
And, of course, one's heart goes out to well-intended hearing parents because the deaf community is not their community.
Yes, and one of the things that struck me as I went into the deaf world is that most deaf children are born to hearing parents, but those parents, by and large, attempt to get their children to fit in with what they think of as the mainstream culture.
Now, it was at this point... that you came up with a really fascinating phrase, a horizontal identity.
Right. So I said that there are really two kinds of identities. There are vertical identities, which I called vertical because they're passed down generationally from parent to child. So one's ethnicity, one's nationality, usually one's language, often one's religion. All of those are things which, even if they can carry some disadvantages, are things one has in common with one's parents, and one's parents therefore tend to reinforce. And then there are what I call horizontal identities. Horizontal because they're learned not from the previous generation, but from a peer group. And those include being deaf, being gay, being autistic, being transgender. There are quite a lot of these categories in which a family that perceives itself to be normal has a child whom they perceive to be in some way abnormal.
And you make the point that we all have, every one of us, vertical and horizontal identities.
Yes, we all have things that we have in common with our parents and that clearly come from them, and we all have qualities that are very much our own. And I ultimately was interested in the idea that all parents seem to set out to become parents with the idea that they'll have children who are somehow like them, and all parents have to deal with the fact that their children are separate and different and have to be accepted on their own terms.
Now, at this point, I think it's important to reveal that you yourself were a different child. Tell us about your horizontal credentials.
Well, I really had two ways in which I was different that I've written about in my book. And the first is that I had dyslexia, and my mother in particular worked very hard to help me resolve my dyslexia and to learn to read and write anyway. And as you've noticed, I became an author, so reading and writing turned out not to be my problem in life. And I think we were quite successful in finding ways around that difference. But I think it set the stage for there to be an attempt to come around the difference of my being gay as I was growing up, and that there was the idea that if we could fix one way of being different, we could fix the other way of being different, and that turned out to be very problematical reasoning.
But you did, in fact, burdened with guilt, try to get out of this particular horizontal posture.
I did. I mean, I always remember the story of when I was about 6 years old and I was at a shoe store with my mother and my brother, and at the end of buying our shoes, the salesman said to us, "What color balloon would we like to have to take home?" And my brother wanted a red balloon and I wanted a pink balloon. And my mother said, "Oh, I think you'd really rather have a blue balloon." And I said, no, I really wanted the pink balloon. And she said, "Remember that your favorite color is blue." So the fact that my favorite color now is blue, but I'm still gay, gives you some evidence of my mother's influence at its limits.
I can't possibly compare my small struggles with yours. My only problem that I can recall was that I was left-handed. But even this was regarded as, incompatible with proper behaviour at school. So one tended to get one's knuckles wrapped if one was writing with the left. But dyslexia, I know any number of people who've triumphed over that and who have a command of language and a love of literature, which is probably all the greater because of their struggle.
And that's part of what I ultimately came to believe as I worked on this book, is that, well, nobody would choose any of these struggles. We all want to protect our children and ourselves from struggles and differences and difficulties in the individual instance, that ultimately there's a great deal to be said for the ways in which struggling against something makes one stronger and gives one a perspective that would otherwise have been impossible. So I found even with people with conditions such as autism, which are generally perceived to be a disaster, there were many people who found occasions for great dignity in that experience.
I would like you briefly to tell us of some of your attempts to cure yourself of the terrible illness of being gay.
Well, I mean, there were a variety of attempts to cure it, but I think the one that I dwelt on in particular is that at some point when I was about 16 or 17 years old, I had read about something called sexual surrogacy therapy, and I thought, right, this is something that's supposed to help people who are having issues with their sexuality. It really was intended for people who had performance issues rather than people who were trying to change from one form of sexual desire to another. But I went to an office on 45th Street in New York in what seemed like incredible secrecy. The idea that I would end up talking about it on Australian radio seemed very foreign to me at the time, but it was a place where I went, and I had these therapists who then set me up with sexual surrogates with whom I could kind of practice in a medicalized setting some form of heterosexuality. And, you know, it worked well enough. I ended up having relations with these women who were not exactly prostitutes, but who were also not exactly anything else. But it felt very painful and humiliating that I was putting myself through all of this. And it did, in fact, pave the way to my later having some heterosexual relationships and, I suppose, loosely defining myself as bisexual. But I felt the whole time that what I most wanted was to be able to have a family, and the other thing I most wanted was to be true to who I really was, and those two goals seemed incompatible, and I struggled desperately with trying to figure out which of them mattered more.
My guest is Andrew Solomon. He's talking to us from New York City. Okay, but let us remind the listener that while it seems bizarre these days, at least in liberal circles, that being gay might require a cure, when you were born in 63, homosexuality was not simply seen as an illness, but as a crime. And many of my oldest, dearest friends took decades before they told me, in strictest confidence, what I'd always seen as patently obvious, that they were in fact gay. It was just dangerous.
Time magazine in 1966, I think it was, when I was 3 years old, wrote, Time magazine, which was then the voice of actually mainstream, not particularly conservative America, wrote, even in purely non-religious terms, homosexuality represents a misuse of the sexual faculty. It is a pathetic little second-rate substitute for reality, a pitiable flight from life. As such, it deserves no glamorization, no rationalization, and above all, no pretense that it is anything but a pernicious sickness. So that's the world I was born into, and the idea that it would emerge as a widely accepted identity was unimaginable to me, and I think to most people who were gay at the time.
Well, the world hasn't changed at all, anything like enough. Our incumbent Prime Minister, who's just had his job back for a fortnight, publicly changed his position on gay marriage. This happened after he had prolonged discussions with a very famous Australian Jesuit who did not endorse the idea of gay marriage, but made him aware that in this country, one of the highest reasons for youth suicide is young, lonely men not being able to deal with the fact that they're gay. It's still a tough world, isn't it?
It is still a tough world. I mean, as you doubtless know, in the United States, Obama came out in favor of gay marriage about a year ago, and the Supreme Court has just ruled that the federal government must recognize gay marriages performed within the states. I feel as though there's really a sea change in the process of happening, but there's still a terribly long way to go. The rate of suicide among gay teenagers is still unbelievably high. There are many, many places, both in the United States and in the world, in which gay people really are not accepted. These are prejudices that die very hard, and the rhetoric of religion has often been used to reinforce these prejudices in ways that I think don't, in my view, serve the purposes of religion, and certainly don't serve the purposes of making for a happy and contented body of people.
Now, a core theme of your book is that our ideas of illness are constantly changing.
Yes, and I think that's really, in some ways, you know, kind of the central idea is that almost any quality that people have can be looked at as an illness or it can be looked at as an identity. And a lot of the time, some people see it as an illness and some people see it as an identity, and many people really have the lived experience of both. So I grew up thinking that to be gay was an illness, and now in my adulthood with a husband I've been with for more than 12 years and children and so on, it's very much an identity. But I still run into contexts in which people are looking at it as sort of, oh, you know, that poor fellow, wouldn't it be nice if he could have a normal life like everyone else? And contexts in which people think about my children, oh, those poor children growing up in that household that's different, when it's constantly butting up against that illness model. And I was very interested in the book in saying, okay, any of these things can be an illness, and any of them can be an identity. Dwarfism, deafness, all of these things can be experienced as illness or as identity. And I want to sort of look at the way we shift them from an illness model, which is one of pain and stigma and attack, to an identity one, which is one of reinforcing people's dignity and right to be themselves in the world.
And you introduce us to parents who still find it hard to know whether to erase or celebrate a condition.
I think it's a question that all parenthood asks. What are the things about my child that I need to fix and change? And what are the things about my child that I need to accept and celebrate? You can't only accept and celebrate. You have to make sure your children are educated. You have to teach them some manners. You have to do all kinds of things to change them and to mold them and to make them into people who are going to be able to have the best and in some ways easiest life in the world. But there are many qualities in your children which are actually inherent to their character and which need not to be improved, but to be celebrated and embraced. And I think the quest of parenthood is a bit like that old serenity prayer. How do you figure out what you can change? How do you figure out what you can't change? How do you decide what to change and what not to change? How do you decide what to accept and what not to accept?
The book is Far From the Tree, Parents, Children and the Search for Identity. The author is Andrew Solomon. And the Little Wireless Program is LNL on RN. Now, you chose to look at a variety of different differences. Some I mentioned in the intro. You look at kids born autistic, dwarf, born with disabilities, prodigies, kids conceived in rape, and some who become criminals. It's a very disparate set of identities. How did you pick the groups?
I started off from the fact that I wrote, as we discussed at the beginning of the interview, an article about the deaf and about deaf culture. And when I was writing it, I discovered that most deaf children are born to hearing parents, and that those parents tend to try to make them function in the hearing world, and that they often discover deaf culture in adolescence when it comes as a great liberation. And I thought how similar that experience was to the experience of gay people who are born to straight parents, who often try to pressure them to function in what they think of as the real world, and who often achieve liberation of some kind when they discover gay culture, often in adolescence or thereafter. And I wrote about that parallel at the time. And then a friend of a friend of mine had a daughter who was a dwarf. And suddenly I found myself confronting the same questions all over again. What did it mean to be a dwarf? What were the ways in which these parents were telling their children, you're just like everyone else, only shorter? What were the ways in which they were actually going to have to help them construct a good identity as dwarfs and introduce them to other dwarfs and become part of a world that included dwarfs? And then I discovered that they were really dozens and dozens of these categories, maybe even hundreds of these categories. And I tried to choose 10 of them, which I discussed in the book, each in its own chapter, that seemed to me to describe the various aspects of identity formation. So deafness, dwarfism, Down syndrome, autism, schizophrenia, multiple severe disabilities, a chapter on families bringing up children conceived in rape, one on families of people who commit crimes, one on prodigies who are also quite overwhelming to their families, and one on people who are transgender. And I decided that those were 10 representative stories, but one of the things that's happened since then is that I get letters all the time from people saying, but why didn't you write about people with Mobius syndrome? But why didn't you write about people with Marfan syndrome? But why didn't
But
you
Andrew, on the other side, on the other that? Side of this argument, many of the people who find themselves in your book were insulted by being in a volume with some of the others. Deaf people didn't want to be compared to schizophrenics. Children of rape felt that their struggle was trivialized by being compared to gay activists. You couldn't make everyone happy.
No, well, one can never make everyone happy. That's one of the great lessons of being a writer. And I felt that the fact that people all objected was a sign that I was onto something. You know, the criminals saying, okay, we've done bad stuff, but we're not as weird as the transgender people, and the autistic people saying, but we're so much cleverer than the people with Down syndrome and so on. But my experience is that each of these differences individually feels very isolating, but that taken collectively, the experience of dealing with some kind of difference in one's children is very nearly a universal of parenting. And so if I could help all of these people to see how much their experience had in common, then instead of feeling like they were in the lonely minority, they would recognize that difference is what unites us and that it's the experience of negotiating difference that defines the quality and nature of being a parent.
Now, we meet some parents who aren't coping, who find the whole problem absolutely overwhelming, but equally, you introduce us to others who began by feeling absolutely appalled by the circumstances in which they found themselves, but who then fall in love with the child.
And I found that was over and over again the case, that if you'd said to the parents in the abstract, how would you feel about having a child? I mean, one mother said to me, you know, if someone had said to me, how would you like to give birth to a lesbian dwarf, I would not have ticked that box. But she then talked about how her daughter was the cornerstone of the family and how she had come to adore her. And I think even when one is dealing with less extreme forms of difference, the process of discovering that one loves one's child with all of his sort of warts and all, as they say, here's a big piece of what parenting is about, and that a lot of these parents ended up being completely besotted with children about whom they would have thought, if you had told them in advance what the challenge was going to be, they wouldn't have been able to cope.
We live in a society where everyone aspires to at least a physical perfection, hence that vast industry of cosmetic surgery. And so very often your parents are dealing with the absolute antithesis of this, aren't they?
Yes, they are. But I think in some ways all of us, I mean, even with children who aren't exceptional in any way, end up having to love the flawed children we have. So I think if you say to any parent, you know, I'm going to take your children away and give you other children instead who are going to be nicer and more attractive and more polite and so on, the parents would be horrified by that. They would hold on to the children they have. We get very attached to our children. The process of taking care of someone is the basis for a very profound attachment. And what I ultimately found was that most of these parents, while they may have said, I wish I could cure my child's condition in some cases, in other cases said I don't even want to cure my child's condition, but in any event, as they were dealing with these children with their various challenges, they ended up really falling in love with them and said they certainly didn't want to exchange them for other children and they certainly didn't wish them away.
Does that eliminate the emotional desire for parents in this category to have a normal child as well?
No, I think many parents want to have more than one child, and I think that many of them want to have a child who they think will have an easier time. I mean, I think over and over again, if the experience of one family of a child with Down syndrome, who Tom and Karen Robards, when their child was born, they were horrified. They were young, hard-charging Wall Street types. They couldn't imagine having to deal with this. And then they ended up getting very involved in reforming the way that children with Down syndrome are taught because they felt that there were not good educational opportunities for their child. They started a tiny little center with a few other parents, which eventually grew into something called the Cook Center, which has now educated thousands upon thousands of children with differences. And I said to them, do you wish that you could make it go away? Do you wish you'd never even heard of Down syndrome? And his mother said, well, you know, for David, our son, I wish I could make it go away because for David, it's a difficult way to be in the world and I'd want to give him a better life. But speaking for myself, it's given me so much more profound and purposeful a life and given me so much stronger a sense of the meaning of human experience. She said that, well, I would never have believed 23 years ago when he was born I could come to such a point. I have. For David, I wish I could cure it, but for myself, I wouldn't exchange these experiences for anything in the world.
For some years, I was involved with an outfit in Sydney called the Center for the Mind, and one of our focuses of study was the prodigy, the child prodigy. Now, you would have thought that this would be seen as a boon and a benefaction by parents, that their child is clearly, at least by some measures, overwhelmingly superior. But you find even the prodigy is problematic to the parent.
I found that the surprising experience about conditions such as Down syndrome and autism was that parents who thought that those things sounded awful ended up finding a lot of meaning in them. And I found the surprise of the prodigy chapter is that parents who would have thought it was thrilling to have a child who was a prodigy ultimately find out it's very different, and that in some ways, although it's less sad to be a prodigy, it's equally challenging. I mean, it's difficult to have the body of an adult with the mind of a child, but it's also difficult to have the body of a child with the mind of an adult. It means you have no real peers in your experience. You're either with people who are engaged with what you're engaged with but don't really want to spend their time talking to a six-year-old, or you're with other six-year-olds who have not the slightest idea what you're talking about, and it can be a very lonely experience.
I want to go to Rwanda with you shortly, but in the book you highlight a number of cases where parents have murdered an autistic or disabled child, making the point or the claim that they couldn't cope. Writing about this and about the way courts have responded, you suggest, well, that there's been a lenient attitude. Do you endorse that attitude or not?
You know, I really don't endorse a lenient attitude toward murder, and I think that there's been a tendency to say, oh, but these children were having such a difficult time, and I feel like there are many, many ways of ameliorating the difficult time of those children. There are many ways of giving them up into care in almost any country in the world. I think sometimes the children are having a difficult time, but I think it's often the parents who believe that those children need somehow to be integrated into the mainstream who are having the difficult time, and I don't think murder is a reasonable way to resolve that.
Mind you, Andrew, the differences from country to country in the willingness of governments to provide help for carers. My country is currently introducing an immensely significant change of policy, a disability scheme, which will give a huge amount of relief to the carers, and a lot of money will go to the disabled child. But let's move on to Rwanda. We've done programs about the kids conceived in rape. You travelled to Rwanda to meet many women who'd suffered horrible atrocities in the genocide of 1994. With other children, you don't know what's coming until they arrive. But for mothers who have been raped, there is no period of innocence. And that, of course, changes everything.
It does. And part of what I wanted to do in writing a chapter on children conceived in rape was to show that this sense of disaffection from and bewilderment about and anxiety around having a child who was different could have to do not only with some inherent or genetically determined quality of the child himself, but also with the circumstances of that child's conception. And the time in Rwanda was, I mean, deeply painful. The stories that women told me there were appalling and awful, but I found over and over again that there was this striving toward building some kind of reasonable life with these children, even in the face of intense social opposition. I mean, the sense that many people thought that children should never have been born, or they should just be abandoned, or, I mean, there was a great deal of prejudice. And I'll always remember on my last day in Rwanda when I was interviewing one woman, an incredibly beautiful Tutsi woman who had had a child through rape and had then gone on and, unlike most of the women with children of rape, had managed to remarry a Congolese man. And we were talking and I did the interview. She told me her very agonizing story, and at the end of it I said, "Do you have any questions for me?" Which I often ask at the end of an interview to sort of equalize the situation. And in Rwanda most people had said, "Will this be published in French?" Or they'd said, do you think you'll use my real name?" And this woman looked at me and she said, "Well, you work in this field of psychology, right?" And I said, "Yes, more or less." And she said, "Can you tell me how to love my daughter more? Because I want to love her so much, but when I look at her, I remember what happened to me and it gets in the way." And I was kind of stupefied and I stared at her completely blankly. And she said very insistently, she said, "Can you tell me how to love my daughter more?" It was a really agonizing conversation, and I just thought only afterwards how much love there was in that question itself.
I'm glad you told that story, because when you come across it in the book, it stops you in your tracks. Although it has to be said that there's a great unspoken fear that all parents have across the world that they may not love their children.
Yes, and I think a lot of the time parents do end up loving their children, but I think there's a tendency to conflate love and acceptance. I mean, I remember feeling as though my parents weren't loving enough at the time that they were struggling with the fact that I was gay. They got over it and it was all fine and they didn't throw me out of the house or anything. You know, it was just a rough period. But at the time I sort of thought, I can't believe that you're not wholly accepting of this central quality of mine, and I feel like you're not loving me. And I think love is something that ideally should always be there between parents and children, and acceptance is something that requires some struggle and some time. And in retrospect, I think my parents did pretty well with it, and I think most, though not all, of the parents in the book ultimately managed to achieve some degree of acceptance, but acceptance takes work.
I mentioned the fact that I was born with the curse of left-handedness. I could have gone on to say that my childhood was in fact quite horrendous, and there wasn't a lot of love to go around. But when I look back, I realise it taught me survival skills. It made me tougher. And I think that very often happens with kids who get what in Australia is described as the rough end of the pineapple.
Right. the old adages that what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. But I think often that process of having in some explicit way to form your own identity, to form your own system of values, to decide that you are going to have a confidence in yourself makes a huge difference. And I think in terms of dealing with difference, there are really three levels of acceptance. There's self-acceptance, there's family acceptance, and there's societal acceptance. And they all play off one another. A condition that the society accepts is more easily embraced by the family and the individual, but an individual who, by walking through some kind of fire, comes up with self-confidence and self-assurance and feels like he really is himself, ultimately makes it a lot easier for the family and brings about changes in the society at large. So they play back and forth, those three things.
In the final chapter, you turn to children who turn to crime, and here you tell one remarkable story of meeting and getting to know Sue and Tom Klebold, the parents of Dylan Klebold, who became notorious in 1999 when he and friend Eric opened a fire on his schoolmates in a high school in Columbine. So you have a family who one day wakes up to find their beloved child has turned into someone they don't know, killed other people, totally and utterly demonized. How can any parent cope with that?
Well, I mean, I think that was the sort of steepest challenge that I looked at, was having a child who had committed a crime and really caused injury to others. The conversation with the Klebolds was quite amazing. It took me years to convince them to talk to me. And then when they finally did, they were so full of their story that they almost couldn't stop telling it. And at the end of the first weekend that we spent together, when I recorded more than 20 hours of interviews, we were all sitting around in the kitchen on Sunday night, all really exhausted from what had gone on. And I said, if Dylan were here now, is there anything you'd want to tell him or that you'd want to ask him? And his father said, there sure is. I'd want to ask him what the hell he thought he was doing. And his mother looked at the floor, and she thought for a minute. And then she looked up and she said, I would ask him to forgive me for being his mother and never knowing what was going on inside his head. And a few years later, I had dinner with her in Denver, and we were talking. And she said, you know, when it first happened, I used to wish that I had never had Dylan, that I had never met my husband, that we had never married, and then this terrible thing wouldn't have happened. She said, but over time, I've come to feel that for myself, I love the children I had so much that I don't want to imagine a life without them. And so while I know it would have been better for the world if Dylan had never been born, I've decided that it would not have been better for me. And since the book came out, I've had really, to me, quite an astonishing number of letters from parents of criminals who've said, I did my best as a parent. I really think I did pretty well. My child just turned out this way. Nobody has understood. I felt so accused all the time. I'm bereft and terrified and saddened by what my child did, but I love my child nonetheless, and thank you for giving voice to that experience.
Andrew, you and your husband John, parents, your children are healthy, but they're born to two gay men, which a few years ago would have been unthinkable. And in a way, that links you to other parents in the book who, as you write, are exponents of revolutionary love against the odds.
Yes, I think I for so long thought that if I was going to be gay, I couldn't have children, and if I wanted to have children, I couldn't be gay. And then the world changed around us. And so my husband is the biological father of two children with some lesbian friends in Minneapolis. I have a daughter with a university friend who had been through a divorce, and we decided we wanted to have a child together. And then John and I have a son who lives with us first full-time, of whom I'm the biological father, and the surrogate for the pregnancy was Laura, the lesbian mother of John's two biological children. So it's an entangled group of essentially five parents of four children.
Andrew, we've got to wrap it. Andrew Solomon, author of Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. Thanks for that. That's your lot for the week. And it's my first week back. I think I've just survived it. Team, good on you. Gail Basario and my executive producer, Mordred Dardias, and Ruta Slee, and Arnold, and the Paderewski of the panel, Paul Gough. Stick around now for the news, and we will see you later.